Hello, I'm Richard Deschamps. This is number 0614, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0614. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, a return visit with Ian Usher, who we spoke to 11 years ago. He's the guy who sold his entire life on eBay and wrote the book, A Life Sold. He brings us up to date with his life.
After Whitehorse, I moved down to Panama. I actually bought a little property in Panama, so I had a home base for a couple of years. After that, I traveled in the States for a while. I went to China, and I worked as an English teacher in China. And then since leaving China, I've been homeless again and traveling with my partner, Vanessa. We do house sitting. We look after other people's homes and pets all over the world. And that's what we're doing here in France at the moment.
Clifford Samuels is the administrator for the Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Association, and he talks about the upcoming Aurora Awards. You can become a member, and members are getting ready to vote on the nominees.
We find 5 weeks is pretty good. We give people about 2 months in advance of that to read the works. They can, people who are members of the society are able to download what we call our voters package. And that is pretty much every literary piece of work that we can get our hands on. The publishers and the authors donate that graciously. And we give that out as e-versions to all paid members of the society.
Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com on the thoughts of life on the moon.
In May of 1922, so almost 100 years ago, there was an article about the idea that there could be people on the moon, and if they were there, they could grow to be 750 feet tall.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0614, was Richard Deschamps, a broadcaster and writer, someone I've spent many years working with. And thank you very much, Richard, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? On May 11th, police in South Euclid, Ohio, responded to the Walmart store after a confrontation between 25-year-old Monika Garner and 26-year-old Precious Jackson. The two women, who once lived in the same duplex, apparently had been feuding for some time as Jackson had previously taken out a protection order against Garner. When they met in the potato chip aisle of the Walmart, Garner pulled down Jackson's mask and tried to spit on her, then reached into Jackson's cart and picked up a 10-pound log of ground beef, which she used to strike Jackson a couple of times in the face. In their report, police identified the meat as a blunt object. Well, personally, I believe that meat is only a blunt object when my sister cooks it, but I digress. Police said Garner has a history of violent behavior. She pleaded not guilty to assault and violating a temporary protection order. You know, she doesn't have a leg to stand on in this one, right? I mean, she's got to be going to jail. And you know why?
Why, it's mainly because of the meat.
Mainly because of the meat.
Yes, it's mainly because of the meat.
Exactly. An Illinois man named Angel may want to invest in a wig with bangs to cover up the not-so-kind message tattooed on his head when he goes for his court date. Angel Schettini, who has the words F-U, and he has the full words F-U, inked on his forehead, found himself in court again to face burglary charges. The 45-year-old man was to appear before a judge in the Chicago suburb of Wheaton. Angel, who also goes by the name of Alejandro Lopez, because, you know, he really is no angel, has appeared in police photos that date back to 2003, sporting the same tattoo on his forehead. Illinois State Police records show that Angel is a registered sex offender with no listed address. Yeah, I'm guessing he's hoping not to have a jury trial. You know, normally I would post his mugshot on Facebook, but our page is family friendly. Anna Cardenas of El Paso, Texas, woke up at around 4 a.m. on May the 11th and felt something dripping on her face. When she turned on the light, she was horrified to see that it was blood. It was coming in where her ceiling fan was attached, and the fan had splattered it all around the room. Anna called 911. Officers determined the man living in the apartment above hers had died. Said Anna, firefighters knocked down his door, and the body was laying exactly where my fan is underneath. He had carpet, but the blood seeped through to my ceiling. Police said the man had died of natural causes and had been deceased for 5 to 6 days. Anna stayed at a hotel for a few nights and has to replace her damaged belongings. She said she's traumatized by the incident. Well, I'd be traumatized too. I'd also be questioning the police about their cause of death. I did a little digging into what happens to blood after you die, so authorities will probably have fun with my search history. Anyway, blood, which is no longer being pumped, clots. If there isn't any kind of wound where blood can seep from, then there shouldn't be enough amounts of it to soak a rug and seep through the floor. And given the facts, how the heck could death be natural causes? I mean, at one point, this guy would have been gushing like a sprinkler. Anyway, we have time for one more story before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. There's something in the water in Seoul, South Korea. According to researchers there, high traces of Viagra and other erectile dysfunction drugs are in the wastewater of the country's capital, and the presence of the drug is expected to increase. Researchers say that chemicals used in the drugs were found in high percentages on weekends in sewage treatment plants in Gangnam, a district in Seoul known for its many bars and nightclubs.
Open Gangnam Style.
The traces of the drug chemicals are studied in two sewage treatment plants as well as received water bodies. Researchers noted the plants weren't able to handle the large amounts of residual chemicals. 23% of South Korean men aged 30 to 39 suffer from erectile dysfunction, and due to the strong effect of the chemical ingredient PDE-51, it's also used illegally as a component in products such as diet supplements, herbal dietary products, and tonic medicines.
Open Gangnam Style.
Well, there's more than just the sun rising in the Far East. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Back in 2010, on show number 0069, we talked to Ian Usher, who literally sold his whole life on eBay. Everything was up for grabs, his house, belongings, friends, and even his job. He turned that experience into a book called A Life Sold. Ian is someone who clearly has wanderlust, so I thought we would track him down and see what he's been up to for the last decade. Ian joins us via Skype from France this time. Hi, Ian.
Hi there, Peter. Nice to speak to you again after such a long time.
Nice to speak to you as well. The last time we spoke, you were actually in Canada. You were up in Whitehorse in the Yukon Territory. Before that, we had spoken to you in Australia. You had been in Hong Kong. You've been a lot of places. How have you ended up in France?
That is quite a long story. This 10 years to cram into a very short period of time. A lot of travel in those past 10 years. Let's see, after Whitehorse, I moved down to Panama. I actually bought a little property in Panama, so I had a home base for a couple of years in Panama. After that, I traveled in the States for a while. I went to China and I worked as an English teacher in China in 2015. And then since leaving China, I've been homeless again and traveling with my partner, Vanessa. We do house sitting. We look after other people's homes and pets all over the world. And that's what we're doing here in France at the moment. We're looking after an English couple's home that they have down here in France.
Now, when we first spoke to you, you had broken up with your wife, which was the impetus to everything that seemed to take place at that time. And yes, when we spoke to you in the second time on this show in the Yukon Territory, you were in the Yukon Territory because you met a woman who was there. So is that the same Vanessa?
No, it's not. She was Mo that I met, who lived in the Yukon Territory. And unfortunately, we separated after about 3 years or so. And after that, I met Vanessa, who is from England. I met her as I was passing through London. And I was staying at a friend's house. She was renting a room at that friend's house. So we met and got on, and we've been living and traveling together for the past 7 years now, coming up to 8 years together.
They say that a rolling stone gathers no moss. There is certainly no moss on you. What's the longest time you've been anywhere?
I guess Panama was sort of the longest place. I had a home base, which was for a 3-year period. Although I was in and out, you know, I was traveling back up to Canada and then back down to Panama and across to Europe to catch up with friends and family. So I was never there for more than perhaps 6 months at a time. So I'd guess that, yeah, that must be the longest. China perhaps was the longest. We actually lived for 11 months in the same place. So, yeah, living in China might have been the longest term home base I had over the past 10 or more years.
What feels, if anything, like home to you?
Oh, I often wonder that myself. And that your home is where your heart is, or your home is where you lay your heart. I feel very comfortable with a sort of quite transient lifestyle, and then making a home base wherever you put your bag down and unpack your clothes, that becomes home for a while. In terms of countries, I'm UK born and bred. I lived in Australia for 7 years. And I guess if any country, if I sort of feel any affinity for a home country, it would be Australia. Although I've now just got residency in France, so France technically is currently my home country.
I know when I spoke to you the last time, again, we talked about you leaving Australia and the breakup of your marriage. Have you been in contact in any way, shape, or form with your ex? And if so... You haven't?
No, I haven't spoke or had contact with her for must be over 10 or 11 years now. And it was, I think the last time I saw was just after the whole Life for Sale in 2008. That'll be the last time I saw her, and contact with her was very shortly after that. So it must be, 12 years now, I guess.
What, if anything, would you say, because of all your travel, is something different about Ian Usher than the Ian Usher I spoke to almost a dozen years ago?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess I feel like I'm much more resilient, much more sort of able to adapt to changes and adapt to difficulties that are presented. I guess that sort of the separation and the divorce was the biggest challenge life had thrown at me up to that point. Since then, I feel, you know, the changes life throws at us, I cope with better and easier, and I'm sort of better able to roll with the punches, I guess, as it were.
Well, before you had this wanderlust, before you started traveling here, there, and everywhere, what was your so-called day job? And what do you do now to put food on a table?
Well, I've never really had a very structured career path in the traditional sense. I trained as a teacher originally in the UK, and then I did a lot of different jobs. Just before the life for sale, I was actually driving monster big trucks in a mine in outback Australia. But I've sort of, at the moment, returned to, I've been doing a bit more teaching online, teaching English online. And myself and Vanessa also publish a magazine for the house-sitting community, which is imaginatively entitled House-Sitting Magazine. And it's for house-sitters and homeowners to sort of help and inform and inspire people who are interested in house-sitting as a lifestyle possibility.
You know, it doesn't make a difference how old you are. If you keep moving around, you will always have family members who will say, when are you going to settle down? Does that happen to you with the folks back home in England?
It does. My mom used to ask that a lot. I think she sort of accepted now that I'm fast approaching 60. It sort of shocks me to say. My mom stopped asking me now, when are you going to settle down? I think she's realized I'm probably not. And you sort of mentioned it. I really do think the sort of travel and change is something that does keep you youthful. It does keep you thinking. It keeps you active, and it keeps life fresh. So I think it is part of the secret of a sort of longer, happier, more youthful life is accepting changes and challenges and enjoying sort of variety of experience.
Well, I guess now that you're in France, you're actually closer to home than you've ever been, your original home.
Yeah.
With all the places you've traveled to, and some shorter, some longer, I believe you said Australia was one of the longest. Has any of your family or friends come to visit you?
Oh yeah, my brother, he's a big traveler too, and himself and his girlfriend have visited us, let's see now, several times. They came out to Australia, and then we've visited them when they've been in India and Abu Dhabi. He's currently living in Abu Dhabi, working there. So I get to meet up with my brother in quite unusual places around the world. And yeah, we've had other friends come and catch up in various different places too. So it's nice. It's harder, I think, to maintain those friendships long distance. So it's always great to catch up in person with friends and see them again.
So your brother travels too. You know, if I were your mom, I'd start getting a complex saying, why do my children keep running away from me?
Yeah, I think she does sort of wonder that. She always despairs when, oh, Ian's off to France now and Martin's gone to Abu Dhabi again. And her kids are never sort of close to home. But we try and get back as often as possible and whenever we're sort of close enough to pop in. I was just back in the UK last month, so got to call in and visit mum then. So We do try to be good sons and visit as often as possible.
When you were little kids, was it always something for you to want to get away, to travel beyond the shores of where you grew up?
I think that came, our parents did take us away a lot. My dad, I think, was part of the sort of inspiration for my wanderlust. He used to go off on his own little adventures. He'd take a motorcycle out into sort of Eastern Europe and travel around Poland on his motorbike or over to Ireland. And he loved trying new sports like hang gliding and skiing and so on. So and my mum sort of went along for the adventure, but I think my dad was the driving force initially. And that's certainly where a lot of my approach to life comes from is inspiration from my father.
Well, I'll probably ask the one question that you can't answer, and that is, how long will you stay in France? Will you settle down?
we're actually in the process of buying a little piece of land, which we're looking to convert into a sort of off-grid property. So it looks like we are settling for a while. And that's just because travel at the moment is much harder than it used to be a couple of years ago. There's a lot more challenges, of course, with travel. So we're sort of hunkering down for a little bit and seeing how things pan out over the next couple of years. But I don't think my traveling days are over by any measure. There's certainly plenty of places on the list that both Vanessa and myself would love to go to.
You must have a lot of stamps in your passport.
Yeah, my I was worried my last one was going to be full before it ran out, but it just made it through to the 10 years, and I got a new one. So I've got an almost empty new passport just sort of begging to be used. So once travel becomes easier, I'll be putting some more stamps in it again.
Bet you can't wait. It's been a pleasure catching up with you, Ian. Mention the House Sitting magazine again and how people can take a look at that.
It's called House Sitting Magazine. It's for both homeowners and potential house sitters, and you'll find it at housesittingmagazine.com.
Ian, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Yeah, great to chat to you, and we'll maybe chat again in another 10 years, perhaps.
Hopefully it'll be sooner.
Yeah, I hope so too. Nice to speak to you again, Peter.
Ian Usher, author of A Life Sold. As he mentioned, he's also got a new magazine that you can check out at housesittingmagazine.com. And you can check out his website at ianusher.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0614, and you'll find links to Ian's site, plus also links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's finger-licking good, if you're into that sort of thing.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the Aurora Awards. Plus, Mark Hartzman is in with his monthly visit, he of WeirdHistorian.com, to talk about life on the moon. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way, and much more in Stuff File News here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere for all your devices and on several radio stations like WLSL LPFM in Dade City, Florida, and CFMU. That's 93.3 in Hamilton. Thank you very much to all who listen to the show, no matter what device or station you listen on. Very much appreciated. Let's get back to the stuff. More than a dozen different police departments in a southeastern Pennsylvania county responded to a wedding brawl that grew violently out of control. Police arrested seven people, including the groom, during the altercation, which reportedly began over a guest letting her 14-year-old son drink alcohol. Officers from Northern Berks Regional Police were the first on the scene, but they called in reinforcements after guests, some shirtless and bloodied, threatened them. Police from 16 different departments across Berks County attempted to control the crowd. One guest was unfazed after an officer twice used a stun gun on him, and the groom, 31-year-old Nicholas Papoutsis, reportedly challenged police to fight before being subdued and charged with disorderly conduct, interfering with the administration of law, and public drunkenness. Emergency workers, meanwhile, treated his bride for alcohol poisoning and dehydration. Police Chief Scott W. Eakin said several people were trying to be a calming influence in all of this, but at that point, alcohol had taken over. Okay, let's just focus on the bride for a moment. How much drinking do you have to do at your own wedding to suffer from alcohol poisoning? And by the way, I hope while the brawl was going on that the wedding photographer kept snapping pics, because these are memories that the happy couple will want to savor for years and years to come, especially since I'm guessing neither one of them can remember the event, even now. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, a woman in St. Petersburg, Florida, was arrested for enjoying the pleasure of her own company just a few weeks ago, and she has been arrested again for the same offense. 38-year-old Vanessa Lee Jones was completely naked when she was seen thoroughly enjoying herself by passers-by outside of a Popeyes. When arrested, Jones showed no sign of being drunk or under the influence of drugs, and there was no evidence of mental health issues. Nevertheless, she was observed outside Popeyes Fried Chicken at 10 a.m., entirely naked and touching herself. Wow. Who knows what she would have done if she got her hands on a drumstick or chicken fingers.
Love that chicken from Popeyes.
If you're into that sort of thing.
Arresting officers also witnessed the defendant masturbating in front of a dumpster completely naked. You know, while I do love me some chicken, I can control my urges over that excitement. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? The Aurora Awards are Canada's annual English language science fiction and fantasy awards. The 2021 edition, which will be an online event due to COVID, will be held on October the 16th. But the voting for the awards will soon get underway at the end of July. Clifford Samuels is the Aurora Awards Administrator for the Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Association. He joins us via Skype from Calgary. Hi, Clifford. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, when, as I mentioned, the voting will start taking place at the end of July. When will the voting period run to?
Okay, the voting period actually runs for 5 weeks. So about the 4th of September, we close it down on, it's a Saturday at 11:59 Eastern Time. We're finding Eastern Time is a great time, gives everybody throughout the country a lot of time to vote. We find 5 weeks is pretty good. We give people about 2 months in advance of that to read the works. They can, people who are members of the society are able to download what we call our voters package. And that is pretty much every literary piece of work that we can get our hands on. The publishers and the authors donate that graciously. And we give that out as e-versions to all paid members of the society. And they can put it on any device, whether it's their Kobo or Kindle, or read it on their computers. And then end of July, they can get ready and start voting.
And how does someone become a voting member?
Actually, it's really, really easy. Just go to our website, which is preauroraawards.ca, and it's $10 for the year, which is a dirt cheap price to be getting a voter's package and to be participating. And it's open to every Canadian. So whether you're a Canadian citizen or a landed immigrant, you can participate in the awards and read some great works, both long and short. And we've got poetry, we've got a huge range of things that are up for the awards.
And we should mention that PRI is P-R-I-X, so it's preauroraawards.ca, correct?
Correct. I mean, the Auroras are both English and French. There's the English side that I'm managing, and then the Boreal, which is a conference in Quebec, does the French side of the awards. And they have their long fiction and short fictions and things like that. But the ones that I manage are just for the English language works.
When it comes to science fiction and fantasy, people often mention the fact that science fiction is really an allegory for whatever times we are living in. And we have spent a horrendous year in the last year, what with COVID and all. Have you seen some of that seeping into what has become this year's science fiction and fantasy?
Not yet. I suspect we will. It takes the process to getting everything out onto the book form and things usually takes about a year. So we should probably start seeing those kind of allegories happening with people coming out. But yes, I mean, science fiction and fantasy has always been a strong proponent of dealing with social issues, and this is one of the biggest social issues we've ever faced.
Tell us about some of the entries, the nominees in this year's ballot.
We've got a really broad selection. We've got some new authors and some authors that have been around in the genres for the science fiction, or not the science fiction, but the novel category. Robert Sawyer's got his Oppenheimer alternative up, and Rob's been a huge proponent for the Auroras and been around for many years. We've got gothic horror with Mexican Gothic by Silvia Moreno Garcia, another amazing Canadian writer out of Vancouver. And we've got newcomer Primi Mohammed with Beneath the Rising, which is a science fiction fantasy horror, which is quite a fascinating thing. Randy McCharles out of Calgary has got his Connecticut Gumshoe and King Arthur's Court, which is a noir fantasy dealing with a detective going back to King Arthur's court, and longstanding author who is an amazing person as well as a great writer, Kelly Armstrong, her romance fantasy, A Stitch in Time, is up on the ballot this year. So you have a huge, broad range of works just in the novel category. But we've got five works in the young adult novel category from people like Susie Vidori and Susan Forrest, and again, Kelly Armstrong. We've got quite a range, and this year we did something a little different. We split what we called our fiction category, the short fiction category, into two categories, short story and novelette and novella, because we found that somebody who writes a five-page story, it's kind of hard to compete against somebody who writes a 30-page story. So we've got authors from new authors, people like Rich Larson, who's been doing science fiction for many, many years, is finally on the ballot, as well as longtime balloteer Derek Kuskin out of Ontario.
With such a broad spectrum of writers available for the Aurora ballot this year, I'm just curious to know, how robust is science fiction and fantasy both within Canada from Canadian writers, and how well do Canadian writers do abroad, or do you know those kind of things?
Financially, that would be something the authors would have to tell us. I do know that there are a huge, huge number of works being published by Canadians. In years gone by, we used to have the novel category's eligibility last for 2 years because we didn't get that many novels. Now we get 100 novels being put up that people have written. In things like the short story, we get hundreds upon hundreds of short stories getting published, some from major publications, some from minor, some are self-published that people are selling. The same goes for poetry. Huge, huge amount of Canadian authors out there getting published. It's really exciting.
I mentioned in the introduction that because of COVID restrictions, it's going to be an online awards show this year, an online event. Can you tell us how that's going to work out and how people will be able to experience that?
The organizers of CanCon, which is the Ottawa Science Fiction Fantasy Convention, are going to be hosting it. They haven't told me the specifics. Last year, we had a person, Mark Leslie, who's actually on the ballot this year for doing an online Aurora presentation. And what will be most likely happening is that we will stream it to both Facebook and to a online YouTube channel, and that way people can watch it live. And then what they'll be able to do is bring in each of the nominees wherever they are located across the country, and when the winning person is announced, they will be able to give their acceptance speech live to everybody, which I think is probably one of the greatest things about our software that we have these days, that we can do these things and everybody can participate. Doesn't matter if you can't afford to fly to the awards ceremony like we always had done. It is fun, but you do miss getting together with people and being able to congratulate them. But this gives everybody a chance to watch it, and they can watch it live. And then we'll record it, and then if they missed it at the time it's on, they'll be able to go back and watch it.
We should mention that Mark Leslie did not turn into a werewolf last year at the ceremony.
No, he did an amazing... Mark has been a huge proponent for the awards, and he is an amazing speaker. And he got all the names pronounced correctly.
that's rule number one.
I always get it wrong. No matter how much I try, I always goof up. We do ask the nominees to give us their pronunciation and their gender pronouns, because those are very important things. There's nothing worse than saying somebody's name incorrectly. And I always make a mistake, so I always have to apologize.
Even though we are still hunkered down, people do get to read more, I guess. It's one of the side products of that. Would you say that the world of Canadian science fiction and fantasy is something that is extremely robust these days?
Oh, absolutely. There's two major conventions that are in Canada, CanCon in Ottawa and When Words Collide in Calgary. Both of those groups have very strong writing background, promoting writing, getting your books sold. And they are helping so many new authors get into the field, whether they want to self-publish or get access to the major publishing houses. And the publishing houses, I think, are much more interested in getting into new authors. And places like Tor.com are doing a lot more novellas and short fiction that they're printing online. So we're seeing a huge resurgent in shorter fiction.
And again, the voting begins at the end of July. People can find out more information about becoming a member so they can vote. And more importantly, can obviously read and enjoy all of the nominees that are on the ballot. Clifford, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh, thank you very much, and I hope everybody joins in and participates. As I said, it's open to all Canadians. It's your chance to be part of it.
Clifford Samuels, the Aurora Awards Administrator for the Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Association. Again, the voting will begin at the end of July, and you can find out more information by going to their website, or you can go to my website at thestumpfile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0614, and you'll find the link.
Incoming subspace signal.
Time to check the mailbag. Last week, show number 0613 was apparently a very useful show for Sheldon Beckwith out in Winnipeg. He writes, "Great show. Not only were Howard Fine, Trevor Cork, and Stuart Nullman great guests, the show was exactly the amount of time I needed to cut the grass." Well, this is nice to know, Sheldon. Hopefully, future shows will give you enough time to regrout the bathroom floor, re-caulk the tub, and maybe even go back outside and clean out those gutters. No matter where you're hearing the show, by the way, thanks for listening. And also, on show number 0612, a couple of weeks ago, we had medical thriller writer Dr. Daniel Calla on the show talking about his latest novel, Lost Immunity. After the show, he wrote on Twitter, "I've been lucky enough to be interviewed by P.A. Holder for over 15 years. Always a treat to chat with him. For an entertaining and eccentric podcast, check out his Stuff File program." Well, thanks for the shout-out, Daniel. And what a coincidence. I've been lucky enough to have interviewed Daniel Calla for over 15 years. And that's it for the mailbag.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
To the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Mark Hartzman, the curator of WeirdHistorian.com. Plus, we do indeed have an Idiot of the Day coming your way. And a few more Stuff File news stories here on the Stuff File program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a New Zealand man who began drawing very large penises around the potholes in his home city of Auckland back in 2018 in the hope of attracting the attention of his local council has been threatened with police action. In a video that road safety campaigner Jeff Upson made after the most recent addition to his oeuvre, he said, "I'm about sick of calling Auckland Transport. So what I've done is I've gone and drawn a great artist's impression of a penis." The video shows two green and pink neon penises. Upson helpfully identified the addresses where the newly eye-catching potholes occurred and their dimensions. Auckland Transport has now promised to take legal action against the phallic fuss maker. Upson received a call from police following a complaint over his graffiti, which Auckland Council says poses a safety risk and distraction to drivers, as well as being dangerous to carry out. Upson estimates that he has drawn 100 penises to date. In 2019, Middlesbrough Council in the UK repaired potholes within a week after their being graphically branded. When a Manchester man used penises to achieve the same result in 2015, the council reacted furiously, calling the drawings obscene, stupid, insulting, and a waste of valuable time and resources. In response, the anonymous artist told the BBC that the council must be very prudish. Well, I guess they're more concerned about the drawings of one's undercarriage rather than the damage the potholes can make to cars. Undercarriage. And finally, in the UK, London firefighters have a peculiar new challenge to deal with. It's not burning homes or even cats stuck in trees, but TikTokers stuck in swings. The London Fire Brigade, or LFB, said its officers have been called to rescue 21 people stuck in children's swings this year and 12 last month alone, linked to a re-emerging trend on the social video app TikTok. Sometimes, as in the rescue of a 14-year-old girl on May the 1st, the firefighters were also being filmed as they try to rescue the trapped swingers. LFB Assistant Commissioner for Fire Stations Jane Philpott said, "It was not for firefighters to judge the precarious positions people get themselves into, but in their quest for TikTok fame, people have been potentially diverting our crews from more serious incidents, and that isn't something we want to see." She asked young people to think twice before taking part in the challenge. "Think of the injuries you could cause yourself, the damage to the swings which have to be cut apart, and most of all, the fact that you're tying up resources which could be needed for a genuine emergency." You know, it wasn't that long ago that YouTube crazes brought out morons trying to emulate what they saw in the videos of others in order to seek fame for themselves. Now with TikTok, we're seeing morons with shorter attention spans doing the same thing. This is a slippery slope. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff All program, shall we? Mark Hartzman, curator of the website WeirdHistorian.com, is back on the show with his monthly visit. This month, he's here to talk about the brief history of the belief that there was life on the moon. Mark joins us via Skype from New York. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Well, you know, it's interesting. Nowadays, we're hearing so much, especially after a recent 60 Minutes piece about UFOs. It's all in the news nowadays. But there was a time when people thought there was actually life on the moon. When did this take place, and how does it come into play with the month of May?
That's a good question. So there have been times in the past when there was believed to be life on the moon. Lots of beliefs in life on Mars. Certainly just the idea of life in the universe is nothing new, although this new UFO news is pretty exciting that maybe there is some kind of life much further out there. But yeah, in May of 1922, so almost 100 years ago, there was an article about the idea that there could be people on the moon, and if they were there, they could grow to be 750 feet tall, which is pretty crazy. That's really tall.
All I'm thinking is a lot of back pain.
Yeah, I'm thinking that how much could the population be? They're taking up a lot of space.
Yeah,
you know, they lay down. You know, you're taking up most of the moon. In fact, if your listeners could go to weirdhistorian.com and look up the article, you can see a great illustration of what that 750-foot moon man might look like. And it compares him to the Woolworth Building in New York City. So it gives a rendition of what the moon man might actually look like. So the reason for all this thought was start with very scientific thought about what might be going on the moon. And one of those scientists was Harvard professor William H. Pickering, who had previously explored ways to contact intelligent life on Mars in the early 1900s, around 1909, when Mars was in opposition. In the 1920s, he started to challenge the notion that the moon was lifeless. He thought, hey, there could be life on the moon as well. And he thought that these markings that were observed on the face of the moon were caused by areas of vegetation, which could include mushroom types of growths that were sprouting up whenever the sun warmed the surface. And he thought these patches of vegetation, the way he explained it is that they shift positions over the surface. This is a quote, shift position over the surface like the canals on Mars. In both cases, the surface of discoloration has changed its place. This cannot be due to mineral or inorganic force. Life, therefore, exists on both planets. Thus, we find a living world at our doors, where life in some respects resembles that on Mars, but is utterly unlike anything on our own planet world. So clearly, you know, because of the giants and whatnot. So part of the reason I think he thought might be similar in terms of huge people, the moon has 1/6 gravity, 1/6 G, and Mars is 1/3. So a lot of those early beliefs of Martians were that they would be much taller. They thought maybe like 7 to 10 feet tall, or even up to 20 feet tall because of the lower gravity. So we could grow taller because we're not being pushed down as much by gravity.
Was anybody concerned that some of these freaky, lanky people will be coming to our Earth and getting hit by doorways and stuff? Like,
they would have a lot of trouble here.
Yeah.
But they would probably really suffer if they came here because they would be incredibly heavy, you know, because of the gravity here. So it would probably be really uncomfortable if they came here. I think they would hate it. You know, doorways aside, they'd have a lot of trouble. So it was believed, based on these different thoughts and theories about, you know, the conditions on the moon, it was believed that a visitor to the moon would experience a remarkable growth spurt if they just stayed there for like a month. So if you went to the moon for a month, the newspaper article was reporting that you would find yourself going from, say, 5'8" to about 750 feet, again, within a month or so, just based on the conditions and the climate there. And that your weight would also shrink, so you'd be about 90 pounds. So you'd be 750 feet tall and 90 pounds. So this is what was being reported 99 years ago in May.
Well, based on that, they should have sent a tailor along with Neil Armstrong.
Yeah. Well, they would have never made it back if they stayed longer than they did. You know, they wouldn't have fit back in with Michael Collins.
That's true. Really, that's true.
We can't get back in. But, you know, it's amazing because so this was this, you know, scientific belief in life on the moon and you know, moon men. Long before that, in 1835, there's a great story called The Great Moon Hoax, where the New York Sun reported that there was life on the moon. And this was before, you know, anyone had like their own telescopes, and telescopes were fairly recent in terms of their power to see the moon well. So the newspaper reported that there was all kinds of life, you know, all kinds of flora and fauna, various creatures. There were tailless beavers, bearded unicorns. People lived in huts. They had Batman, these men with wings that were flying around, and they had these amazing elaborate illustrations of all this stuff. And this went on for a week. Like every day there were new reports from these different scientists who were peering through their powerful telescopes. And it spread around the world, the story that there was life on the moon, and people believed it until it was finally revealed by the end of the week that the whole thing was just a hoax. But it was great for sales.
You know, we can't see the dark side of the moon or the far side of the moon, so I want to spread the rumor that on the other side of the moon, there's actually a McDonald's and an Olive Garden.
Just waiting for us.
Just waiting. And I think, you know, unfortunately, Michael Collins passed away recently. I think he went to his death knowing that, but didn't tell anybody.
That would be an amazing secret. But if there was an Olive Garden, those breadsticks would have to be huge for 750-foot tall people.
Yes. So
400-foot breadstick.
Well, for them, it would just simply be finger food. Literally, yeah. Finger food.
There's another little interesting point about all this life on the moon stuff. This I find kind of fascinating. So in April 2019, an Israeli probe crashed on the surface of the moon. You know, some listeners might remember that when it hit the news. And along with that probe, there was a payload, which included some human DNA. It was part of this mission to sort of create like a backup of planet Earth, basically, if we can have our DNA somewhere else. You know, it's like a hard drive backup, basically, of humanity. There were some tardigrades on the spacecraft that crashed. And tardigrades, they're like super creatures. You know, they're probably Earth's most powerful creatures. They can survive being boiled at 149 degrees Celsius. You know, they don't have to eat for like months. I mean, these things are amazing. They're tiny little sort of microscopic creatures, but they can kind of survive anything. So it seems possible that maybe these tardigrades survived and will live on the moon for a while. And who knows, maybe they'll grow like Pickering thought they would. You know, maybe they'll be huge by the time humans get there again.
Well, something's got to be going to the Olive Garden.
That's right. They can eat the huge breadsticks and grow big and mighty.
Wow. Well, at least we haven't had a mathematical or soothsaying creature as we've had in the last couple of months. This is something totally different.
Yes.
Although these gigantic creatures, we don't know if they can tell the future, so maybe they're not as impressive as sapient pigs and the like.
That's true. Yeah. Well, who knows? Maybe they'll learn more things while they're over there. And who knows what awaits us? Maybe they'll get in touch with the aliens that we're waiting for.
Always a pleasure to have you on, Mark. You mentioned the website, weirdhistorian.com. People can go there. Quickly describe to us what we'll find when we go to that website.
You'll find all kinds of weird history, all sorts of weird science stuff, like we just talked about the moon, about life on Mars. Lots of weird stuff about spiritualism and the supernatural, human oddities, animal oddities, all kinds of wonderful weird stuff.
Excellent. Thank you once again for being on the program, Mark. Looking forward to hearing what you have for us for June.
Thanks. Always good to be here.
Mark Hartzman, author of The Big Book of Mars, talking about the moon this time. His website is weirdhistorian.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0614, and you'll find the link to Mark's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff file presents the idiot of the day.
Eight New York City men ran a nearly year-long $2 million fraud by applying for unemployment cash in the names of people whose identities they'd stolen. The suspects got $600 weekly payments in the names of hundreds of people. So, how did they get caught? Well, four of them, 20-year-old Carlos Vasquez, 18-year-old Angel Cabrera, 19-year-old Gianni Stewart, and 18-year-old Seth Golding, posed with their ill-gotten Benjamins in online photos, which the feds distributed to the media. The cash was either directly deposited to their bank accounts, sent as checks to their homes, or issued in debit cards made out to the names of the victims whose identities they'd stolen. Six of the eight men were arrested in the federal sting. At press time, the other two are still at large, but it's only a matter of time. Because why? Oh, why? Would you take pictures of yourself for social media to brag about the identities you've stolen in order to commit fraud, and in said pictures, you're just showing off wads of cash? One reason, and one reason only. You're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0614. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0614. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including the podcast station, cyberstationusa.com, kdxradio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, truetalkradio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and CFMU in Hamilton. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.